Hey everyone, welcome to the Sunstone Podcast. My name is Jackson Washburn, and I'm excited to be stepping on as a new host for the Sunstone Education Foundation. You see, I'm a Mormon. Well, technically a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, if we want to be specific. And I believe that Mormonism is not only worthy of study, but really has a lot to offer the world. My hope is that you'll spend some time with me as we wander through both mists of darkness and along the iron rod, because that's what Sunstone is all about. And no, I don't mean apostasy. I mean taking the time to build bridges of understanding across lines of difference, across the many Mormonisms that exist in this wider restoration movement. To me, that's approaching the Zion that I find the most fulfillment and growth in. So stick around, settle in, and whether you're coming from inside Mormonism, you're a visiting Gentile, or really anything in between, get ready to learn, to grow, and to find a place at the table just for you. Thank you.
Believe in, my dear? Where is it you call home?
Hello everyone, welcome to the inaugural episode of the Sunstone Podcast with your host, Jackson Washburn. Today we have a very special guest, David Osler, who recently wrote a book titled Bridges, Ministering to Those Who Question. For those of you who are kind of tuned into the Mormon Studies crowd, this book might be familiar with you. You might have caught David on another podcast. But I just want to quickly introduce him. David is a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Throughout his life, he's served in various leadership capacities, including mission president of the Freetown Sierra Leone Mission in West Africa. He also served as the director of the Hill Cumorah Visitor Center and Historic Sites in Palmyra, New York. Currently, he's involved with Leading Saints and the Faith Matters Foundation. Him and his wife, Rochelle, are the parents of six adult children and five, soon to be six, grandchildren. Is it six now, David?
Yeah, Emma. Congratulations.
Yay. All right. From what I understand, you've raised your family in a variety of locations, New Hampshire, Utah, Minnesota, London, but you currently reside in Northern Virginia.
That's right, Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Well, perfect. We're so happy to have you on today. And I hope with this being kind of the pilot episode that you and the audience will be patient with any of the audio quirks and just as I figure out how to, start hosting podcasts. I've been on the receiving end of plenty of podcasts, but this is the first one that I'll be hosting myself. So thank you for coming on today.
Well, I'm kind of honored to be on your inaugural. This is like heavy pressure on me, I think.
Oh, geez. Well, I'm glad we can share that pressure then. So would you mind giving our audience, just for those who might not be too familiar with your book, kind of the background, just briefly about how it kind of came about, what inspired you, and what the purpose of the book is in your eyes?
Thank you. Yes, I decided to write the book about a year and a half ago. And kind of what led to it is my wife and I were called in our state to work with leaders to help them understand why people disaffiliate, stop attending, become inactive, whatever term you kind of want to use on it. And as we went through that assignment, we understood that leaders have often a variety of a varied level of understanding about why that happens. We provided some training, we provided some insights to our leaders, but we concluded that it's really a complex problem, both in terms of understanding why people disaffiliate, but knowing how to reach out and minister to them, not to per se have them come back, although that may be the case, mm-hmm. but to understand them and to understand what they're feeling and to find ways in which to connect with them. And we found that it wasn't a simple training process. It wasn't a 10-minute presentation or a 20-minute presentation to help leaders understand that. The issues are quite complex at times. They differ from what often leaders think are the standard reasons why people would stop believing or would leave the church. And there were very little resources available to leaders to be able to understand this issue. So about a year and a half ago, I felt it was something that I could contribute to the material that's out there that's available to leaders or to parents or to friends to help them understand first, what are the issues? How do they play themselves out? And second, how can I as a believing member or a leader respond to people that have concerns about belief in the church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's very admirable. And after having read the book myself, I found myself both very much encouraged and inspired by what I had read, but I also disappointed. And I want to unpack that just a little bit, just in the sense that I feel like your book, and others have described it this way as well, from what I've seen online, it's very much a landmark publication in ways, I think, because for many people, this is the first really published effort that seems to capture accurately what many people who are disaffected from the church or have gone through a crisis of faith, this is the first book that they've maybe encountered that accurately depicts what they've experienced, but also provides a straightforward, practical, sincere attempt to kind of bridge that divide for people who aren't necessarily experiencing that themselves, but have others in their lives who they wish to minister to, who they wish to dialogue with and understand better. So if there was any disappointment that I experienced, it was just that I wish that a book like this had been written sooner, right? I think it's so great. I look forward to the literature that it will, you know, perhaps inspire and the good work that will follow. So I appreciate what you've done here. I feel like it's a pioneer work in ways, and that collectively as a church, for those of us who are Latter-day Saints, we seem to be becoming more and more sensitive to those who are experiencing crises of faith, for those who have left the church or decreased their participation in the church due to concerns of this nature. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, thanks for your kind comments. And I too didn't see kind of material. And I go back in my church leadership experiences and realize how I so often fumbled about these issues because I didn't know. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything that helped me gain that, and because of that, number one, there were a whole set of people that I didn't help, and number two, there were probably people that even in my best efforts and trying to be sincere, I responded in a way that actually added to their burden and added to their pain, so to some extent, I kind of put this book up as an offering. Almost kind of like repenting of my own kind of ignorance and my own misactions that didn't help when I was in a position where I should have known better.
Yeah, I think you make that very clear in kind of one of the introductory comments that you make at the beginning of the book, where you say, as I look back on my years of church service, I realize that there are many who unnecessarily suffered because I didn't know how to effectively minister. I didn't know how to comfort them in their challenges. I didn't know how to mourn with them. To them, I offer this book asking for their forgiveness. And since I'm still learning, I ask for forgiveness of the mistakes of effort and understanding that I will yet make. I feel like that really set the tone of the book from the get-go on a very nice place. And like I said earlier, you've served in a variety of leadership capacities within the church. And like you said, this book reflects a lot of the lessons that you might have learned over the years when it came to fulfilling your own callings or the times in which, you know, people might have come to you. So are there any, if you don't mind, are there any particular experiences that you recall where, I don't know, maybe you left and you were just kind of dissatisfied with maybe how the conversation went, or you learned an important lesson, maybe an example or two that sticks out to you?
When I was a stake president, there was a leader that I really kind of struggled with. He was he had a ward leadership role, and I had a vision of what he and his calling ought to be, and it didn't measure up. It doesn't measure up for any of us, right, with what we could or ought to become. But for him, you know, there were some gaps, and they were visible to me, and I felt that it affected other people. And I think I saw the gap and didn't see the person. I didn't see him and where his starting point was. I didn't see him and try to understand why, you know, first off, whether the gap was really there. Secondly, whether the gap was meaningful. And third, whether, you know, why that gap was there in the first place. I wasn't helpful to him. I judged him. I saw that gap, and it divided us as opposed to help us work together in such a way that we would be united in what both of us wanted to accomplish. This person served, and he served with energy. He just didn't serve in a way that I thought was the ideal. So I just misjudged him. I know another person came into my office and expressed concerns about belief, and I gave them what I thought were the best answers of how to deal with that, and they were what probably most bishops or, you know, other ecclesiastical leaders do, which is, you know, read the scriptures, attend the temple, attend your meetings, fulfill your calling, and things like that. And I never got underneath what the real issue was. I just stayed at the surface. I used those pat answers. I can kind of still see his face and know that that in that interview, in that discussion, he lost confidence in me. I don't know what's happened to either of those brothers, and I'm kind of, number one, embarrassed that I don't, but number two, a little fearful that you know, I might have contributed to them losing trust and confidence in the church, because as its representative, they couldn't have confidence and trust in me.
I appreciate you being forthright with that. I can say within my own experience, I've had varied experiences with church leaders at different capacities. And while, you know, I would definitely say that all of them were sincere men and women at times who were actively trying to help me or minister to me. I think all of us, right, if any of us were called into those capacities, it would be messier than maybe we would want. I don't think any of us have the answers or the means or the training to handle all those situations perfectly. So I appreciate that, you know, both in the book and from what you've expressed, that you look back at those as kind of educational moments in your life. And I feel like you touched on some tensions that might exist, particular in the last example you gave, when it comes to communicating with other people. I felt like your book has the potential to be applicable to people outside of its own audience. And if, correct me if I'm wrong, but your primary audience would be current church members and leaders, right, who are looking to minister to those either going through crises of faith or have come out the other side and are now disaffected, right?
Right.
Okay. So I felt like the title was just so apt because of that, because the book itself functions as a bridge between these groups of people that historically, especially in recent decades, have felt very distanced from each other. They haven't had the tools to communicate with one another, and I feel like on both sides of the divide, that today there's a lot of effort being made from both those who have, you know, perhaps left the church, or those who are still in, to understand each other, to grant each other the space to be authentic, to hold their own beliefs, and to maintain those loving relationships that they had when, you know, they might have belonged to the same group. So with that in mind, what is the primary fruit that you most want to see come from this book?
It's probably illustrated in just a couple of stories that in the last 2 weeks I've become aware of. You know, the book's been out for about 3 or 4 months, and
right,
so some people have read it, and some of them write me and tell me about their experiences. I talked to a woman who is in a faith crisis. Her husband doesn't really understand what she's dealing with. She bought the book, believing it would be something that she could help him with, understanding who she is and where she's coming from. And you know, I was grateful that she said that, but then she went a step further and she said, but what I found is it's actually helped me better understand my husband. Mm. So there's a whole section here about just ministering to people who are different.
Right.
And the perspective of the book was taking ministering to those that don't have orthodox belief or are in a faith crisis or have left. But she found those principles were something she really needed to be able to maintain and connect and build a relationship with her husband, because the faith issues had divided them. Mm. And that was very tender to me, because it wasn't the direction I thought she was going to go. You know, I kind of thought she'd say, "And now my husband understands me." But, you know, it was, now I understand my husband. Mm. I got another note from a woman who left the church maybe 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and her father hasn't really talked with her since. And so, you know, a big divide, you know, a complete rupture in a family because of faith. And she actually did send a book to her father, and her father outreached to her after he read the book in a very personal way, that closed the rupture. And now I don't know if either of these people will change their belief,
right?
But what I do know is that there's relationships that are valuable and important to all four of them that now are a little bit different, maybe a lot different, maybe a lot better, because they have more understanding. They found things that they could use in their own life that would help them close gaps and build bridges. And, you know, whether it's a leader doing the same with a member, and I've had those stories too, or, you know, a father and a daughter, or a husband and wife, or two friends, our lives are interpersonal. Mm-hmm. And being able to kind of take these divides off the table and being able to connect regardless of whether we believe or behave exactly the same way, to me, was the goal of the book.
Mm-hmm. Right. And while your primary audience might be members who are still in the church, and are still believing or occupying that kind of space of faith. Many of our listeners on this podcast might identify or have experience in working through these crises of faith within the context of Mormonism, with Sunstone's motto being that there's more than one way to Mormon. We try to honor all of those different paths and journeys and because they are all so personal. And so while your primary audience is currently or largely current church members and leaders, presumably coming from more, let's say, religiously conservative backgrounds, what do you think this book can offer individuals who might consider themselves religiously progressive or perhaps no longer wanting to participate in the church? You mentioned the example of the lady who was able to send her father a copy of the book. So would you say that represents a lot of the stories that you've been hearing? Just on my end, I've seen a lot of individuals who identify as post-Mormon or inactive who have purchased the book and herald it because they feel like it really told their story accurately. What are some other maybe responses that you've gotten from that?
So, I've let me tell you three instances. So one is, I know a woman who said to her bishop, if you want to minister to me, read the book, put in the effort required to understand me, because the book actually gets to the issues and the way I feel and think in a way that would be useful for you as a leader to be able to minister. So, that's one. Talked to an individual. I interviewed him for the book. I didn't include it in the book. It was a telephone interview, someone I had never met. I did the interview with him, and then he came to an event that I did last August, and kind of with tears in his eyes, he said, that interview allowed me to stay. Mm. He's not, none of his issues go away, right?
Right,
I didn't answer any of his questions about whatever the hard issues were for him, but it kind of gave him, number one, an individual who wanted to truly understand what he was feeling, which he said hadn't ever happened to him, that allowed him to really express who he was and what he was feeling without any sort of kind of risk of kind of social isolation or labeling or, other sorts of costs that can occur for such a member. And then I think it gave him a little bit of hope that some of these issues can be addressed inside at least kind of the culture of our wards or families.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the third one, right? Have I gotten up to three or have I only got?
Yeah, you're at three now.
Okay, good. So there's another one, but I can't remember it, Jackson.
Oh, no, it's totally fine. you brought up kind of the dynamic of wards, and I feel like there's a lot of potential value when it comes to how the LDS Church is organized, when it comes to the geographic boundaries and the congregations that we organize ourselves in. Because it forces us to interact in spaces with people that, much like with a family, we're born into families, and that's something that we can't necessarily control. Although, of course, relationships can change and things like that. But much like with a ward, you're put in a space with different people than you in close quarters, where you're going to be rubbing shoulders with them, you're going to be talking with them, exchanging ideas. And sometimes there's friction in that. A lot of times, actually, I think it's a great space that has the potential both to be a refining space for the people who are engaged in it, but then also one that can run the risk of people experiencing hurt, because we're all imperfect and we can all, none of us are perfect at communicating or interacting with one another. And so that's the risk that you run. But you share, I feel like one of the great ways that your book is applicable when it comes to members who are trying to understand and dialogue with maybe friends or family members, others who have gone through crises of faith or have left the church for whatever reason. I felt like even though a lot of the material that you presented, you know, you might draw from quotes from general authorities or examples from the scriptures, advocating, urging people to behave and minister in a Christ-like way. A lot of your advice, I felt like, was applicable beyond just religion. People, regardless of kind of the circumstances that they're in, would be able to take the principles that you were teaching and use it to help them become effective listeners. So do you feel like that's accurate at all? Maybe a lot of the things that you were advocating for were also applicable just outside of perhaps a bishop sitting down with someone for an interview?
Yeah, clearly. It's interesting, when I was doing the research on this, I'm not a researcher. I'm not a PhD, and this isn't an academic work. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I tried to understand what thought leaders, researchers, academics, you know, the wise people, mm-hmm. Would say about these kinds of issues. And one thing that was really interesting to me was I got drawn into a guy named John Gottman.
I've heard of him.
And John Gottman is a researcher on marriages.
Yes.
And he has kind of opinions about how successful marriages are built. And it was interesting to me as I, you know, read his material. I actually purchased one of his books. That's really an academic book. Kind of went through his methodology, his study, his findings, and the like. All of our relationships have differences in them. Whether it's a difference between me and the person sitting next to me on the pew, me and my bishop, me and my spouse, me and my coworker, me and someone who has different political views, mm-hmm. or a different worldview, me with someone from a different culture or a different race, we're all different. Mm-hmm. And those differences don't go away. They're there. They're resident underneath everything. And so when we communicate, those differences can play themselves out. And they can play themselves out in the intensity of a marriage, as Gottman identifies, or they can play themselves out at the Thanksgiving dinner table, where you have people from this political party that watch this television show, news show, versus people of a different political party that walk another. Or you deal with it in context of religion, where, you know, there's people who believe one way and people who mm-hmm. believe another way. And those differences can divide us. They can enrich us. Mm-hmm. They can unite us. They can divide us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is based on how we approach those differences, and how we approach the people that have those differences. So I really believe that these principles apply to other places where there's heartfelt differences. Mm.
I completely agree. Kind of at an early stage of my life, I had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of different religious worldviews. And so during high school, I became very much involved in kind of interfaith activism, ecumenical work, things of that nature, where I would go and visit these different places of worship, these different people with religious or spiritual worldviews that differed from mine, and also people of no faith at all that identified in different secular worldviews. And so I definitely felt like, even though I was involved in interfaith organizations, the principles that I was learning during that experience, those experiences I felt like they were so applicable outside of just religious conversations, right? That they were desperately needed in today's society when it came to politics or any of the other differences that you talked about. I felt like one of the biggest takeaways, and it still continues to be so, for my involvement in talking to people of different religious traditions, it's really the art of effective listening. And that's something that you touch on in the book on pages 107 to 108. You list some bullet points of what some of the keys to being an effective listener are that you've learned. And I think it's actually kind of interesting. A couple days ago, I was walking on campus. I'm at Arizona State University right now. And there was a booth, a student booth, and their club, I think, was called Bridges USA, which is kind of fortunate given the podcast right now.
Yeah, great name.
Right. and while they're geared to more bridging political divides and getting people to talk past party lines, I was able to get this blue rubber bracelet from them that says on it, I knew once I saw it, I had to pick it up, but it says, "Listen first to bridge divides." And I've been wearing it ever since. And I plan to continue wearing it because I feel like that's just so important, both in my life. And it's something that you so strongly expressed in this book, that one of the most powerful ways to minister to people or to understand them, it's by simply listening to them. It's by giving them a platform to express themselves. So if you don't mind, can we go through some of the some of those keys to effective listening that you learned and talk about ways that those are applicable in different contexts?
Sure.
Right. So I'll just read them off one by one, and maybe you can unpack each one and tell me, you know, ways in which it can be applied or maybe different things that you've learned from it. So the first one is being ready to listen, and that includes finding the right space, the right time, putting away the phone, turning off the music. I remember when I was serving my mission in Armenia, for those of us who have experiences on missions, it was, it's very much encouraged that when you come into someone's home and you're interacting with them or you're about to teach a lesson, that you ask them if they can, you know, maybe turn the TV off or turn the radio off or whatever it might be. How does that produce maybe an environment for effective listening?
Well, so if you're talking about something that's difficult and very personal, and in the case of faith, where someone like has a faith crisis, or in politics where someone is kind of wired about a particular political issue, by finding the right space, you actually set a tone and an environment that says you as the listener are interested, you want to know, you're not being defensive, you're focused, you're present, and in that presence, you're ready to engage. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about kind of be ready to listen, some of these things that I wrote about were about the environment. But there's probably just as much and maybe more that it's about the emotion and the state of mind of the listener. I know that when I was a bishop and someone would come into my office, sometimes my mind, when we were talking about a problem, would be centered on how to give advice, how to fix their problem, how to tell them what they were doing needed to change, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's not being ready to listen. Ready to listen means that I'm really focused on them, what they're feeling, what they're saying, why they're saying it, and eliminate any sort of distractions that are around it. So right. Turning off the TV, having the right place in the right setting, having, if it's a discussion that requires privacy, to have kind of a private setting so that you're not interrupted by other people or distractions, mm-hmm. or whatever. So, you know, that be ready part, it's probably a bigger deal than what I wrote about in the book, but you know, so often when we engage in conversations, we're not ready to listen.
Right. And I feel like that plays a lot into the next bullet point about showing care through body language, tone of voice, by smiling, making eye contact. I think a lot of what you're expressing is just being present with the person, by giving them your full attention, by being there in the moment with them. And that allows a much more fruitful conversation and interaction. You also advise that throughout the conversation to, you know, give brief verbal responses such as okay or I see, to show that you're listening. That's something that I try to do. And some people, in my experience, might be confused by that, especially if, let's say, you are talking to someone that you might very much disagree with, right? Those are very neutral ways to just affirm that you're listening, that you're there with them, without necessarily jumping in at that moment to say, you know, well, I disagree or something of that nature. You allow them to just naturally continue what they're saying. And you also mentioned in the example of let's say, as a leader in the church, it's applicable beyond that, of course, but to avoid giving advice. Can you unpack that? What's so important about avoiding giving advice or jumping in immediately with your own commentary?
I think most psychologists would say that unsolicited advice is not only not helpful, but it actually is unhelpful. Mm. It creates barriers. So usually advice is most helpful when someone is seeking it. When there's, let's say that a bishop is sitting down with a member and the member is saying, "Bishop, I have some problems. I have problems with belief. I don't believe this, that, or the other." Mm-hmm. And if the bishop listens for 5 minutes and then gives advice, he hasn't understood, he hasn't spent the time building any sort of relationship where, number one, that advice is being looked for yet, or has any sort of understanding of what advice might actually be helpful. Mm-hmm. So I just think generally we want to give people advice, but 95% of the time in which we want to give advice, someone's just not looking for it.
Yeah, I can definitely say that I've experienced that in my own life, where maybe a friend or someone has come to me and expressed a concern, something they're struggling with, maybe a question that they have or something like that. And just personally, I have a tendency to go into problem solving mode, right? Where I just immediately think about a solution and it seems very simple in my mind, like, well, this is what you need to do. But that can be off-putting. I've had experiences with individuals where I learned afterwards that wasn't the response that they needed to hear in the moment, right? And so I feel like you're also expressing that there's a time and a place for these things. And it requires a certain level of discernment on maybe both individuals' part to understand what the proper and appropriate response in that context is.
Yeah, I just I think it takes a while to truly understand what someone is saying. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that when I've interviewed people around faith crisis, so someone who's in a faith crisis or has transitioned away from the church, when I talk with them about the concerns they have and the feelings that they had, often as they describe interactions with other people, they will describe a slow opening of their concerns and their feelings. Mm. They'll kind of test the water. They'll see whether someone truly wants to understand. They'll determine how much trust and confidence they have in that individual to hear something that for them is very heartfelt or very painful or very confusing.
Right. And go ahead.
Just won't do it all at once. It's not a 5-minute conversation.
Right.
You know, it's a long conversation, and it requires a level of investment for someone to truly understand why someone else feels that way. It's not just about faith and belief. It's about anything where there is kind of a significant difference. So if there's a racial issue, for example, you know, it's very difficult for one person who grew up in one culture or racial background to truly understand what it's like to experience what someone else is feeling. And that's not a 5-minute conversation.
Right.
You know, that's a long conversation. So if we don't invest the time to do that, you know, we have no relationship to be able to comment on it. We have no understanding or foundation to offer up thoughts.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I feel like even though social media and the technology that's available to us today and allowing us to be more connected than ever before has been a blessing for so many people and has so many good things to it. One of the negative side effects, in my opinion, is the way in which it isolates complex issues, that it really promotes simplistic answers to complex situations. And it, even though it makes us more connected than ever before and allows us to, you know, maybe interact or get to know with people that we wouldn't have crossed paths with otherwise, the risk that we run is having exchanges with people, especially on contested issues, where we take literally no time to understand where they're coming from, where, you know, these are very rapid exchanges that completely decontextualize the issue from the individual and how they might be viewing it, where their approach is from. And so, like you said, it's an investment. It's one that's ideally best done in person, where you're able to have these kinds of face-to-face interactions, where you're able to see body cues and hear things such as tone, and it allows for levels of dialogue that, you know, technology just might not provide. And I'm certainly guilty of getting in Facebook arguments or things like that. I mean, I love talking about religion, especially. So I'm always talking about that with people. But I completely agree that it takes effort and it takes work to understand why someone believes what they believe, you know, why they're coming to that issue the way that they are. And a way that you can encourage this kind of investment when you are talking with someone is you recommend that instead of asking just yes or no questions, to pose more open-ended questions and statements, such as, you know, tell me more, how did you feel, and what was it like to experience that? I feel like this is especially applicable when talking about religion, where later on in the book you wrote, or I guess early in the book on page 28, you wrote that ultimately belief comes from what we experience and how we feel. And so because of that, it takes some unpacking, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we live in this world that is all centered around ourselves. You know, the world is, my world is only seen through my eyes and my experience. So my beliefs and my what I think and feel is really a product of every experience and interaction that I personally have had, and yours is completely different than that. And it's completely rational that we would end up in different places of belief on many issues. And so if we recognize that there's a starting point and a set of experiences that have gotten that person to the place they are that is different than us, and that it's rational to them, it's feels, you know, that's where they are because of what's happened to them mm-hmm. and the way they've both interpreted and experienced the world. And you can't take that away from them. You can't say that, you know, what they're feeling isn't right, because what they're feeling is what they're feeling. And it's based on years and years of experiences that kind of have gotten to them to that particular point. So you can't devalue that.
Right.
You can't throw that away. You can't say that your experiences are better than theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They're just different.
Yeah, so, and you can't accurately represent that in just a soundbite either, right? Like you said, it takes unpacking, it takes investment, and it takes building a real relationship with someone. And you know, time is the key element there. It's not just something that can be done, you know, within a single tweet or a series of exchanges. And so that's something that I really appreciated about the book is that, you know, besides just understanding, you're really encouraging people to foster relationships with one another, even though they might have differences in belief or background or experience. And while a lot of people, especially maybe coming from more of a church background, have this understanding of ministering as, you know, how can I serve you, right? What's something maybe physical that I can do for you? Is there some, you know, maybe some housework or is there anything that your family needs, maybe monetarily or I don't know. A lot of people might think of ministering as something more physically oriented or that requires you to, you know, work through an issue with them. But from what you've demonstrated, I think you show that ministering is also just listening to someone, just allowing them to speak for themselves without offering, you know, maybe advice or additional commentary in an attempt to agree or disagree with them or share your own view. Listening is ministering. Building relationships is ministering, and that's kind of what these bridges are based on.
Yeah, I try as much as I can in the book to quote from leaders of the church that kind of give family members or local leaders confidence in the material that I'm presenting. This is a section where I didn't find a lot.
Mm.
Which was interesting to me. You know, I read 6 years of all of the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency's General Conference talks. I did Google searches, and there just isn't much that is there. That's not an indictment of the church,
mm-hmm.
But it's an area that we certainly could develop more. But I did find in other people some material that is really very helpful here. And one of my favorite quotes is from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk that I include on page 106 from the book. And if I could just read that, I think it really kind of gets to this issue.
Yeah.
His name, the best I can pronounce it, is Thich Nhat Hanh. And he says, deep listening is the kind of listening that can help relieve the suffering of another person. Call it compassionate listening. You listen with only one purpose, help him or her to empty his heart. Even if he says things that are full of wrong perceptions, full of bitterness, you are still capable of continuing to listen with compassion because you know that listening like that, you give that person a chance to suffer less. If you want to help him to correct his perception, you wait for another time. For now, you don't interrupt. You don't argue. If you do, he loses his chance. You just listen with compassion and help him to suffer less. 1 hour like that can bring transformation and healing. And I just really love that. And when I think about ministering, whether it's a church program or just a word that we use for Christian and Christ-like compassion, I think that is at the bottom of it, is seeking to deeply understand another person. And I think there's religious connotations on this, even doctrinal. When we think of in a Latter-day Saint sense of the atonement of Jesus Christ, we're certainly drawn to this concept of overcoming the consequences of sin. But there's another part of this that's mentioned in Alma chapter 7, where it talks about how Jesus took upon us all of our pains and sufferings and infirmities so that he would know how to succor us. And, you know, according to that doctrine, he came to know us. Now, we can't access that level of knowledge because of who we are and our own personal limitations, since we're not the Son of God, but we can take the time to listen. And I think that's Christ-like. I think that is the essence of Christ's mission, was to come to understand us, know what is in there, to connect us. And I think when we talk about becoming like Christ, that's what it means.
Yeah. I have two quotes that come from outside of your book. When it comes to listening, and they come from within our faith tradition. One of them is by Linda Bentley Johnson in her book, Every Good Thing, which was published through Deseret Book in 1998. And she says that, quote, "It is holy work to hear people tell the truth about their lives. In a world of small talk and shallow conversations, it is refreshing to listen to others get below the surface and speak about what is real in their lives." And so in that sense, right, listening becomes holy work. It becomes ministering, like you've been saying. Another one is by Checo Okazaki. And she says that this is from her book, Disciples, also published in 1998 through Deseret Book. And she says that not judging is an act of security and self-confidence, like a walnut protected by its shell. A person who is tolerant and accepting of others, a person who feels no need to judge others, knows what he or she believes and does not feel threatened or attacked because other people believe differently. A tolerant person can listen to all kinds of things and say, "That's very interesting. I think I understand what you mean." I love Sister Okazaki. She has so many amazing quotes, and I wish she was still with us today. But Would you say that those all, you know, very much supplement kind of what you are advocating for in your book?
Yeah, they really do. It's interesting. They're both women. I appreciate you bringing their voices in. Right. I think they're more articulate about this subject. Not sure why, but I'm grateful where they contribute on this. And I think, you know, those two quotes get to the essence of relationship, of understanding, of shared connection, that probably we all really, really need and want.
Right. And you bring up the fact that they're both women. I think it's possible that, you know, maybe they might have personal experience, maybe feeling marginalized or feeling like they're not fully listened to in a church that often, you know, historically has prioritized male voices or you know, it especially has more representation of maybe male leadership than it does female leadership. I think we're getting better at that. And promoting female voices and active leadership within the church. So that's something that I'm hopeful about. But for those who are on the margins or even outside of the church, in this whole bridge building process that you've been describing, I know that there can be a lot of pain on both sides. There can be a process of deconstruction, kind of no matter what perspective you're coming from. And people can make mistakes. It's messy, right? So what role, you know, kind of flipping your book a little bit, you speak primarily to people who are in the church or in leadership positions in the church, how they can minister. What advice or encouragement or what would you recommend to those who are themselves struggling to negotiate their space within Mormonism? Do they have a role in this effort beyond just those who need people to listen to them more? Not that you know is illegitimate at all, because right, that's the purpose of your book. But what role can they also play? A lot of the people who might be tuning into the podcast right now, in acting in accordance with a lot of what you've recommended.
Yeah, I purposely excluded this question from the book. Because I did not want there to be some sort of obligation to close the gap of understanding that leadership has with this group of people.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. Onus isn't necessarily on them to do this kind of healing reparative work, right?
Yeah. There just are clear gaps of understanding on the part of generally authority figures, but also people that are kind of considered the most believing members of the church about this subject. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to focus my attention on them to help them find ways to close that gap of understanding that would translate into a different culture and different ways of acting. That said, let me kind of go to your question. I know a number of participating members of the church that have that don't believe everything,
right?
And maybe some don't believe most of it. Maybe some don't even believe any of it, but they choose to participate for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And at times it's really difficult for them to participate, and particularly in a ward culture where these issues are less well understood, and the culture makes it difficult for someone with this kind of a voice to be heard or to be understood. But I think that there are ways that that people who don't have full belief and people who see some of the challenges of ward cultures can participate and can create bridges. Hmm. I talked once with a stake leader, and she said, I don't go to Sunday school to kind of have to deal with all the problems in the church. She just didn't want to kind of have a lot of debate in the ward. I get that most people come to church to feel peace and to feel kind of connection to God. And I think that there's ways that members without full belief can participate and can be authentic and to express who they are and what they believe in a way that still matches that vision that one woman was aspiring to have in her Sunday school class or Relief Society class. I think it means that we recognize the diversity of need that is there. Mm-hmm. I think we recognize that not everyone either feels inclined or is troubled by issues that are, really important to us that create dissonance. I think we learn ways to be able to communicate and support people who do raise their hand and say, I'm troubled by this. And find ways to be able to support them in the class so that the culture doesn't overwhelm and drown out or exclude that voice. We can affirm their statement saying things like, I know how difficult it must be for you to, raise your hand and say something that probably most people in here, are not concerned about. I really appreciate your courage. I just want you to know that I'm glad you're here, mm-hmm. and kind of pattern a behavior for other people.
Right.
Now, not everyone can do that or wants to do that or wants to take that kind of burden and responsibility on. But culture doesn't change unless we help it change.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that everyone has to write a book or everyone has to participate in every lesson along those lines. But I think we can each, with our individual circumstance, whether we have power or no power in a ward, whether we feel articulate or, you know, just don't feel like we can even raise our hand and express disagreement, there still are things that individually that we can do. And I think in the process, it helps our culture improve, evolve, mature in such a way that the aspiration that we have of a community of saints trying to come unto Christ can be better achieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had the opportunity to attend the Sunstone Symposium this summer. And, you know, while Sunstone would be, you know, very different than, let's say, your average ward, right, and attract very different audiences, I feel like I also learned very powerful lessons in that space because of the opportunities that it allowed me to have in talking with different kinds of people with different backgrounds within the larger Mormon restorationist movement, those who might, you know, be formerly Latter-day Saints, those who identify as different kinds of Mormons. Sunstone, just one thing I appreciate about it is that it also provides individuals the experience to have those kinds of interactions. I was able to sit down with quite a few people who, are different than me. They, you know, we don't agree on everything. We identify differently. But the conversations that we had and the connections we were able to make were very meaningful to me. And it was because of these kinds of principles of active listening and bridge building that you have talked about and advocate strongly for in your book. So I just want to thank you for that. And I want to recommend to anyone that might be listening, if the things that David shared today are of interest to you, if you feel like they might benefit, you know, maybe friends or family members or even yourself, regardless of what background you're coming from, I think there's a lot of application here. It goes beyond currently active Latter-day Saints and church leaders. There's a lot of really important principles here for listening. So, David, I just want to thank you for coming on, for sharing your experiences and your views, and for being a voice within the larger Mormon community that's attempting to help our culture and to, you know, build bridges of understanding across these different groups, across people who have had different experiences. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jackson, for having me on. And I do want to thank Sunstone and the Sunstone community for trying to broaden the tent, if you will, mm-hmm. to be able to allow, you know, people to find different ways to express their spirituality and to be able to connect with people. I live in Virginia, so I'm not out in Utah much and kind of miss out on some of that, but I appreciate being able to participate today in another ways that I have with Sunstone.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you heard and you'd like to promote more content like this in the future, consider checking out our various donation options to help keep Sunstone thriving and accessible to people just like you.